I want to start tonight with two scenarios. During the debate over same-sex unions in the state of Iowa, Zach Walls, the child of lesbian parents, testified in the Iowa House of Representatives. Walls described the normalcy of his family and his own success in life and school. I guess the point is that my family really isn't so different from any other Iowa family. We just hope for equal and fair treatment from our government, Walls continued. If I were your son, Mr. Chairman, I believe I'd make you very proud. I'm not so different from any of your children. My family really isn't so different from yours. His testimony went viral in February 2011 and currently has more than 17 million views on YouTube. Eventually, it resulted in a book deal and his participation at the 2012 Democratic Presidential Nominating Commission. In connection with Mother's Day in 2011, the organization Believe Out Loud, slogan, A Million Christians for LGBT Equality, released an ad showing a female couple with a blonde-haired, blue-eyed child tentatively entering a church, hesitant about their welcome. As they walk down the aisle, the camera lingers on the wide-open eyes of the child as he takes in the surprise, whispers, and pointing that ensue. The congregation seems unwelcoming. They turn away. But at the front of the church, the family encounters a robed, older, white male pastor saying in an authoritative voice, "Welcome, everyone." The future suggested for lesbian and, by implication, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Christians in this ad is the opening up of an already constituted church space to include even LGBT Christians. The church doesn't change itself. It simply remains what it is and adds a message of welcome, a message given to the couple, to the family, by the patriarch of the church. The initially unsettled reactions of the normalized people suggest that despite what one might assume, God's message of love reaches even so far as to include same-sex families with children who want to go to church. A sense of smugness, a logic of distinction from other Christians who do not yet recognize just how far God is willing to go, pervades the ad. Further, inclusion is connected to reproduction. The church constitutes itself as a site of welcome through the speech of its authorized representative, the priest, who sees and names the humanity, the recognizability of the couple. Both these vignettes make the case for queer equality through a focus on family, on normalcy. They represent the desired political, ethical, and spiritual act as one of inclusion. Gay families aren't so different from other families, the first story suggests. They too can produce successful children and distinguishable from those of heterosexual parents, thank God. And the second story encourages Christians to congratulate themselves on their inclusivity and kindness. But the Christians don't really need to change. They just need to say, yes, we'll let you in. You can come in and be here with us, where you obviously want to be, since we've got the goods. These scenarios dramatize the characteristic shape of Christian discourses around queer lives, while also touching on a number of issues connected with what is often called homonormativity, and in relation to the burgeoning political ascendancy of the struggle for marital recognition as the focus of gay and lesbian activism in the United States. Queers in queer politics find themselves riven between seemingly incompatible visions of political and social futures. On the one hand, marriage equality is a question of significance to many persons' lives, as well as an achievable political goal. Supporting marriage equality thus serves now as a low-cost way of placing oneself on the right side of history's arc toward justice. In contrast, other challenges affecting queer persons and queer communities, particularly in their intersection with poverty, race, immigration, gender identity and presentation, sex work, colonialism, the legal system, and disability, seem much less tractable. We find ourselves unable to imagine a truly different world, and so we hope for better lives inside this one, lives in which we may be able to succeed, may be able to live with those we love openly, and not be punished for our differences, you know, be just like everybody else. The critical and radical edges of queer theory and queer activism are being co-opted under neoliberal political developments that focus attention on individual choice and self-realization while taking for granted that large-scale responses to social challenges are inconceivable or even undesirable. Or in the words of one European thinker, we think that nothing but the world can be the case. We can't imagine a different world, so we imagine success and inclusion in this one. But does hope for a better future mean envisioning the possibility for all persons to live in accord with their true identities inside an integrated social whole, in which the goods that some persons already enjoy, we imagine, are extended to others? Ought queers to, as it were, come into the social, socio-political space hoping for welcome in the way that lesbian couple tentatively hopes to be permitted to participate in the church service in this story? Or is an ethical relation to the future one that requires appreciation for, visions of, best perhaps expressed in art and performance, a symbolic order, an order of representation that admits fragmentation, incoherence, and negativity? The transformation that has taken place from the days of ACT UP to the achievement of the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and the support for marriage equality of President Barack Obama and others, has shown the theoretical possibility for gays and lesbians, at least some, to be integrated into the existing social order. Yet the gain in marriage and death, dealt and suffered, comes at the cost of shifting the burden of the appearance of difference to racial, national, and religious others, to the poor, and to those indecent queers who seek neither reproduction nor integration. And these forms of political and ethical progress, as well as the vision of religious inclusion represented in that church space, depend on visions of sameness. Think, for instance, of that recent Rob Portman coming out in support of marriage equality only after his son comes out as gay. Now that he recognizes the gay, as it were, as a familiar rather than a dangerous other, I mean the gay produced by him, as a matter of fact, now that he sees sameness in the gay, he is willing to extend them the barest minimum of privilege. But what if queers are different? What if ethics and politics, what if visions of a different future don't depend on the claim to similarity? What if queers are, or can be, a threat to the social order as it currently exists? And what if queer life promises not inclusion, not wholeness, but the possibility of an ethics not depending on the similarity of the other to me, nor on the decency or deservingness of the other? What would social justice look like then? And what pleasures might be possible, what promises might we be able to make each other if we grounded ethics and justice not in what we have in common, but in the recognition that we are strange to each other? Some of us have sex in public and remain strangers in that act. Some of us experience the glorious transience of sexual contact in bathhouses and orgies. Some of us hover at the edges of gay bars, worrying that our attractiveness is fading. Some of us live lives structured by different time periods. When dating persons of the opposite sex, we appear straight. When dating people of the same sex, we appear gay. And so we come out again and again. Some of us were lesbians until graduation. Some lesbians until graduation live apparently straight lives for a long time, kissing women on the sly and wondering what might have been. Some of us are trans men who give birth. Some of us are genderqueer and refuse all existing forms of gender identification. Some of us are asexual. Some of us practice power exchange once in a while or all the time. Some of us are barebacking, while some of us will not have oral sex without using a dental dam, and so on. And some of us look at each other and refuse each other. Those irresponsible queers are not the ones we are fighting for. We, if there is a we, are made up of people who live radically different lives from each other and who seek or refuse or are refused inclusion into normative or heteronormative society, which is also capitalist society in very different ways. We live in families of choice rather than families of birth. Or we seek to create families of birth out of families of choice. Some even create kinship through seroconversion. Some of us want to belong, some of us do not. But as the queer theologian Marcel Altus Reed says, we did not coordinate this. Neither are the queers any better, but their claims cry out to heaven. We dream of wholeness, but wholeness is not a truth of human existence. Lack, loss, and fragility belong to all human lives, even though differential access to power and privilege means that such forms of loss take very different forms in human lives. So when we imagine a future in which we get to be included, a future without loss or lack, we not only imagine something impossible for human beings, we also refuse to consider how the existing structures of social orders might be shifted in radical ways. We refuse revolution in favor of inclusion. How then can we come together to create, to imagine, to build a heaven for queers? What might it mean to live into, for those of us for whom God language is meaningful, the God whose back is made of difference, the God who will lick my fingers, again in the words of Altus Reed, the God of whom in Jewish and Christian scriptures only God's ass crack may be seen? It's true, it's in the Bible. Altus Reed gives us a method for queer theology. To do it means, she suggests, first, never repeat. And second, keep decency at bay in order to fight the theological vocation of normalizing discourses about God. Instead, and in this context we might say, as with some art, Altus Reed claims that theology's main function is to be fictitious. It aims to lie in the sense that its mission is to express the inexpressible, utopia, the intuitions manifested in vague suspicions and intuitions of different orders in sacred and human society. Or again, queer theology is the theology of bearing behinds as an act of protest and defiance against ways of thinking which must be disauthorized and discredited. And if queer holiness has a characteristic, it may be unrepresentability. Holiness is always the holiness of the other, she says. To ground an ethics, a vision of revolution, a way to touch the holy in queer lives, loves, and practices, or at least in what they signify at their best, because it's not as if queer lives and communities are free from all the injustices that dominate mainstream society. To ground an ethics here, a vision of revolution, might take, I want to suggest, the following forms. First, we need to embody our relations to each other in terms of strangeness, otherness, and incomprehensibility. Instead of grounding ethics in sameness, as in the stories with which we began, we have to recognize that such examples are precisely the opposite of what both theological and queer ethics ought to be. We need an ethics grounded in strangeness, maybe even in hospitality without limit. Glory holds may set up an ethics of indiscrimination. That is, anonymity and non-reciprocity permit the giving of a gift that can't be returned in any direct sense. And the invisibility of the one at the other side of the glory hole means that one can tell very little about whether that person is similar or different. No debt economy arises here. One gives, perhaps, to whoever comes along. Surprisingly, the Christian thinker Søren Kierkegaard insists on something very similar. He says, in effect, that whoever crosses my field of experience, anyone that I encounter, is someone I have a duty to love. If I can see myself in that other, if there's sameness going on here, or if I insist on being loved back, equal exchanges, Kierkegaard considers that a degraded form of love. So Kierkegaard says, no, love has to be indiscriminate and given unconditionally. He worries that erotic love, as he understands it, the monogamous love of a couple turned only to each other, will close people off from encounters with others, from encounters with strangeness. Bathhouses, lesbian kinship networks of lovers and ex-lovers, and cruising in public spaces and in truck stops have the potential, although it may not always or even perhaps very often happen, to cultivate that same ethic of indiscriminate generosity and indiscriminate hospitality, to give and receive without discrimination and without return. These are schools for generosity. Second, we need to envision our relationships in terms of fragility and incompletion. This means accepting finitude, limitation. Finitude or limitation that I'm not unlimited, that I won't live forever, and that I and every one of us will die one day, that I will lose every person that I love, and that's the best I can hope for. That's a successful outcome, that I or my lovers die and still love each other at that point, places limits on visions of normative social relations, on capitalist economic orders that insist that if we just worked hard enough, if we just structured ourselves differently, we wouldn't fear loss, and we wouldn't need to fear loss. The dream of wholeness is also a dream of invulnerability. To accept vulnerability and fragility as deep resonances, both in theology and in queer communities, I'm going to mention only two of them. For the sorts of religious traditions that believe in one God, it's very important that the world was created as limited. This means that limitation is not something we can run away from, or when we do, we set ourselves in contradiction with ourselves. Accepting vulnerability and fragility is accepting ourselves and others. Instead of holding on to dreams of some sort of perfection of ourselves and perfection of social relations. In queer communities, to see ourselves as inhabiting shared vulnerability and limitation may help us to move away from condemnation and distancing from those people over there who aren't proud in the way we think they should be, or who are too slutty, or who still experience shame over their sexual orientations, or who hide their sexual practices because they don't want to admit that they enjoy what others condemn, even those who enjoy sexual practices that they themselves abhor, or perhaps even who have less sex than we think they should. Let's put it this way, not everyone who practices BDSM necessarily finds it a liberating and wonderful fact about themselves, and not everyone who enjoys being a fuckpig wants to celebrate that openly. Shared vulnerability and limitation provides an ethics of acceptance of the strangeness of the other, an acceptance that I cannot encompass all desirable forms of life within myself any more than I can evaluate all other forms of life from within my own preferences, desires, and practices. Third, we need to learn to ground revolution or visions of revolution in the different temporalities of queer lives and in the economic implications of such temporalities. As Altos Reid says, there is no dream of heaven unless the capitalist dictum, there is no alternative, is overthrown. Theology supports capitalist life with its logic of debt relations, and capitalism insists that queers must and will grow up and become successful and productive citizens, or else it gets better, right? But what about those queers for whom it doesn't get better? Or what about the argument made by theorists like Jack Halberstam that queer life offers the potential for an extended adolescence rather than going through the reproductive logic, the order of the self same, made up by birth, marriage, reproduction, and death? In extended adolescence, we might value the generosity. We might value the expenditure of not subordinating one's entire form of life to the need for social reproduction under capitalism, that next generation of workers that somebody's going to have to birth and raise. In which we treat our bodies as private property and the home as private sphere to grow new workers, new citizens who will be resubjected to the same disciplines. Or what about the temporalities of lives that move back and forth between different kinds of practices? Lesbian, bisexual, queer, straight for a time, trans, and so on. None of these kinds of lives are lives that are lived like straight arrows moving forward into the time of the better. As such, queer lives can pose a challenge to the logic of capitalism. Let me develop that a little further in relation to the fourth element I want to highlight: implications for dreams of inclusion and success and security. The logic of capitalism as we currently experience it is one in which we are told, be a responsible citizen. Plan for your future. Protect yourself and your family. Don't get pregnant, unless you're ready. Do use condoms, wear a helmet, or else you'll get what's coming to you. So as a productive worker, I have to find ways to secure myself against possible risks in the future. For instance, I need to contribute more to my 401k if I have one. If I don't, I better go out and buy an IRA. And then I ought to get health insurance, and disability insurance, and life insurance, and an emergency fund, and a life happens fund, and so on and so forth. Not only does this logic pay no attention whatsoever to the genuine economic reasons why people have been struggling so much recently, more significantly, from the direction of a queer theology, this logic insists that I can guard myself against risk, that I can hedge, that I can protect myself. There's a famous story that Jesus tells once upon a time about a man who continually works and puts grain in his storehouse, his emergency fund, his 401k, every day, and congratulates himself on this, saying, man, I'm going to build bigger barns to store all my goods, and then I can relax and enjoy life in security. And God says basically to him, you fool, tonight you die. Instead of spending his goods freely, instead of risking loss in relation to the other who is strange, he dies with nothing. Tim Dean, who studies the culture of barebacking, describes why some gay men deliberately seek to expose themselves to the risk of HIV infection. Barebacking is an act of acceptance of risk and limitation. Now, the issue here is not whether barebacking is good or bad. That's a different conversation. We can have it later on, over drinks. But one of the things that it may say is to say, yes, life is risky, sex is risky, love is risky, and I'm going to refuse to pretend otherwise. I'm going to refuse to pretend that I can protect myself against risk. So here, too, we see two kinds of ethical potential. One is in relation to the self, that I move away from seeking to protect myself at any cost against risk, and from what the future may bring, and instead I learn to spend freely what I am and what I have. The second is a social good that is not currently being realized, at least in the United States, as much as we would like. One in which I might work for the creation of social structures where I won't have to spend all my time and energy, all my money securing my own future, or where I won't be blamed for not doing so. I think here of the country in which I was raised, Norway. It's far from perfect. Norwegians are the most self-righteous people you will ever meet. But I never, ever worried about things like not having health insurance or not having disability insurance or whatever, because everyone has those things, at least at a basic level. And so the future doesn't have to be secured by my own efforts in the same way. I don't have to pretend that I can make myself invulnerable. Giving for free moves us from capitalist relations of nothing for free, nothing for the undeserving, nothing for those who do not subjugate themselves to earning and desert, to a slutty distribution of ourselves and what we have. Instead of an economy of restriction or an economy of redistribution, we think of new forms of production. Instead of an economy of debt, we create economies of other relations. We never think sexuality outside the economy. But we don't just redistribute the already existing borders, the already existing forms of accumulation, that you might get what I have. A different order of production is needed. And finally here, I want to mention the value of non-reproductive sexualities, ass-fucking and clit-licking, for instance. Remember, two of the challenges here we're discussing here is not to repeat. That is, not to insist on staying within an order of the same, and not to insist on a future that's just a better version of what we already have, with a little bit less lack and inclusion for the good and decent ones among us. Non-reproductive sexualities can point us towards what is left behind and left out as non-reproductive, as not furthering normative social needs. But it's also a relation to the future that refuses the reproduction of the social orders of late capitalism, state control of sexuality, police monitoring of trans women accused of prostitution simply for being out and about in public. A refusal of legitimacy as legitimacy gets controlled by all-consuming visions and surveillance of who counts as in and out. This is a queer theological ethics of otherness. Not because I recognize you, not because we are the same, not even because I have the power or the capacity to include you or not, as in those two scenes that we started with. No. A queer theological ethics, grounded in queer communities and queer bodies, gives us a heaven for queers, or a queer heaven, in which we no longer insist on regulating each other and no longer insist on a politics of recognition where you have to count as the decent, recognizable human who wants and needs what I want and need. A queer heaven can only be one in which I stop trying to include the other, and stop trying to recognize the other by extrapolating from myself in a kind of ultimate narcissism. Instead of reproducing the logic of God the Father, I'm going into the theological language here, who regulates authoritarian and authoritative structures that then get repeated down from God the Father, to the sanction God gives the nation state, to the sanction God gives to only heterosexual reproductive marriages, which the state must now protect, to the sanction and worship of the needs of banking and financial systems. Instead of this divine authority in front of which we must all kneel and take whatever is given us by the one who is the only truly masculine male in Christian traditions, we find another option. We seek to bite God's nipples and soft lips in order to achieve some oblique transcendence in our lives, as Marcel Altaz Reed says. Or as I would say, if we move from dick-sucking to clit-licking and touching God's transcendence, we will no longer gag on God's fullness, nor be forced to swallow an eternal emission grounding reproductive social normalization. Instead, we may find the differences of pleasures inside justice but outside the law, a different future, a heaven for queers, in which we are strange to ourselves, to each other, and seek God the stranger.